Well, thank you, Libby. And, hey, everybody, my name is Jim Jones. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Jim.
It's by the grace of God and the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, I've been kept sober since January 12, 1984. And terribly grateful for that. It's the only time your sponsor was ever wrong. You were sober enough, but that's all right. Everyone's entitled to one mistake. About 2 weeks ago, I began thinking, what kind of an idiot am I? I volunteered to introduce Clancy. I thought, there's leading with my chin, but then there's, you know. I have to thank Barbara for being here. Barbara, we love you so much. And if I may, before I introduce Clancy, she mentioned something about Charlie that I just wanted to say. One of my fondest memories is we were getting this place ready and to move down from the Wellness Skills place. Was coming up here one day at noon, and Charlie was in the kitchen, and he had a 20-year-old newcomer in tow, and they were talking about AA and installing the sink in there. And I will have that image in my mind as long as I live, and it's very, very sweet, and he's a wonderful, wonderful man. And actually, introducing Clancy is almost, in AA anyway, is sort of like introducing the president. I mean, everybody knows who he is, practically. And if you don't, you should. And, you know, what do you say? Because his message has been carried around the world, you know, literally around the world for many, many years. What struck me as I was thinking about what could I possibly say about the man was that, all of this incredible message that he has and the gifts that he has as a speaker at the podium are one thing. And that's what we hear. That's what we hear on the tapes. That's what we hear if we come to meetings like this or at conferences. But the last time Clancy spoke here after the meeting was when I had a rare chance to see the man walk his talk, and that's really what I want to share as intro. Everybody had gone virtually, and I'd locked the door, and I was taking Clancy back to the hotel, and he had walked on ahead of me, and Barbara and Charlie were both here. Charlie was in failing health, but was here. This was 7 years ago. And I was wondering where Clancy had gone, and I walked to the end of the balcony out there, and I heard his voice, and I looked over the rail, and there was nobody around to impress, I can assure you. And Clancy was helping Charlie into the car, and Charlie, here, let me help you. He couldn't get in by himself. Now, that touched me, and it got me to thinking today, you know, how many millions of little acts of kindness have gone on in Alcoholics Anonymous since Bob and Bill met 65 years ago? And how many countless little acts would never have happened were people like Clancy not around to continue to carry the message, which is just kind of what we do. And it is a great pleasure, and I want you to give this man a big cornerstone welcome. Clancy.
My name is Clancy Emerson, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi,
maybe my wonderfulness that Jim talked about will rub off on you. I'm really very happy to be here tonight. I'm happy. I want to thank Mark, who used to be at our group in L.A., for picking me up at the airport. And he and his lovely wife, Jacqueline, have been sharing with me. And we were talking tonight at the recent International Convention in Minneapolis. I had a panel on gratitude. And they had a panel at the same time on sex. And they asked me what I'd rather have. I said, I remember gratitude. you know, I've been around a while, and I when I turned 73 years ago, I had a feeling, you know, when you turn 70, and doesn't feel that way now, but before, you know, you're on the home stretch. I mean, you're coming around the clubhouse turn at 70. You just, there's a guy up there with a scythe waiting for you. Hurry up, son. But I've been doing the best I can, and some guy, my doctor gives me iron tablets to take, which is supposed to help you, I guess. And I've been really feeling pretty good until about 3 months ago, in some hideous fit of I felt good one day, and I've been reading about it in magazines, and I tried a Viagra. And I wanted to see if the story of Lazarus is true. Well, I did not realize that if you're taking iron tablets, you are not supposed to take Viagra. And now, every 4 hours, I face north. I much enjoyed these speakers this evening. By odd coincidence, I know them both very well. I think I met them both at the same time. I think I met you both at the Midwinter Midland Conference in 1967. And we were good friends ever since. And Charlie, and I'm sorry he's gone. Barbara told me something at the break that's really touching. And she didn't tell me to be publicized, but it really is a touching thing. They were married a long time. She said she had a dream night before last, where she was in an open field. And there was a fence, and on the other side of the fence, she saw Charlie walking towards her. And she started to run towards him, and then she woke up, and just so upset that it wasn't true. But nice thing about AA, I guess, if you believe in AA and some of its theories, that maybe you're sitting in the meeting waiting for you, Barbara, and just your luck, it won't be an open meeting, and you won't be able to go in. I don't know why I said that. I did not think of that. I am just a channel. But on the way over here tonight, I asked Mark to drive a little bit out of the way. We came off the Central Expressway, and I said, turn right. And we went by where the new SMU football stadium is. We went down one block on Airline Drive, and then one to Drexel Drive, and then I turned right, and we drove three or four houses. And I looked at a house, and that's where the end of my terrible drinking life came. It was just over at that house. I remember coming back to that house after being drunk somewhere for a couple days, and my life was in a shambles. I had been working, I came here to work for Tracy Locke, big advertising agency, and I'd worked on the Elsie Delmer ads, if you remember those, if you're old enough, and they were pretty good. And then I lost my job because of my drinking. I got a job at Southwestern Engaving, where I was production manager, and I lost that job because they repossessed my car and I couldn't get to work. And it was so terrible. And my daughter was born in the hospital. They had to find me in a bar on Portland Avenue to bring me to the hospital. I was telling Mark, and doctor said, your daughter's got some unusual severe RH problem. We don't know if we can save her. And I said, I'll take my blood, doctor, whatever blood you need, take it from me. I'd rather be dead than have her. And he looked at me and he said, no, she has a better chance with the blood she's got. She is now 11 years sober in AA, anyway. But anyway, I stood outside of that house, and that morning, just about almost exactly 42 years ago, and my life was over. I had no place to turn. I was desperate, and I knew I had to get out of Texas because I knew my wife probably, she had apparently, when I was gone, had sold all the furniture, taken the children and left with what money she could get, and I had no idea where she went, and I had no car. They'd repossessed that. But I knew I had to get out of Texas for a very good reason. Because I had been signed out of the Texas state insane asylum in Big Spring, Texas, to her. In those days, I don't know how they do it now, but you were signed out to a loved one. And if they decided that you should be back in there, they just called up and there was no hearing or anything. You just went back in. And I had a whole winter full of electric shock treatments in that hospital. Ha, 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 yeah. And I knew she must have turned me back in so I had to get out of here. I haven't thought about this for a long time. I had some friends downtown. I've got to get out of Texas. And because they'll nail me. And one of the guys said, well, I know a guy that runs the driveway service. I don't know if you've ever seen that service where you put your car someplace and they transport it to a different place. And if you're a driver, you can go down there. I'd like to drive a car. And they give you the car to drive if you have a good driving record. So I went down there and I got a car to go to Los Angeles. And I got out of here quick. And I remember going through Big Spring and just kind of averting my face. I had escaped once from that hospital and they brought me back because I don't know if you've been around outside of Big Spring, but they can see you're running for 3 days. Why, there goes that little Yankee sumbitch now. That's why I got all the electric shock treatments. Because I wasn't in there for alcoholism. Nothing in my commitment paper said alcoholism. I was in there because I'd been a successful suicide that had been revived. And I was a successful suicide because I was in such a terrible state. Because when my son died and I was in jail, I took a vow in his little casket, this will never happen again. I had a bunch of little girls and one little boy, and it just about killed me. And I had such a great zeal to stop drinking. It was so wonderful. But eventually, it always with me, eventually, whenever I stopped drinking, and all the years, I never thought about it until years later in AA, but all my life, the problem I've had with drinking is I stopped drinking with and without a solemn oath and all the reasons. But one night, sooner or later, somebody sneaks into my bedroom and puts an invisible spring in my gut. And my gut in the morning, they start to press that spring, and the irritability comes back, and restlessness, and the depression, and the self-pity, and the anger at how I'm being treated. Then it's just a matter of time, because there's nothing that stops that feeling except a couple of drinks. I've spent thousands of dollars in psychoanalysis, and psychoanalysis tells me why I have it, but it doesn't get rid of it. And I've read books and philosophies and other things. And I was working in El Paso. I'd been on the college faculty there. And I just directed a grand opera, actually, to the staging and direction of it. And I stayed sober except after one day. The spring was there. And then it got bad. And it got bad, and I couldn't stand it. I need a couple of drinks so bad I couldn't stand it. I'm doing it for my children, but their noise made me crazy. Mary, take your sisters and go to your room. Let Daddy alone. God, I'm sorry. We'll play tomorrow. And the job I loved, I didn't like anymore. I didn't like the people. Didn't like the way I was being treated. Sick of all this crap. And the only one thing to stop was a couple of drinks. And you can't drink, so what do you do? One day my wife took the kids to church, and I just took the car home and put it in the garage and hooked up a hose in the exhaust pipe and turned the motor and went to sleep and died. I didn't know what to do. And I died, I guess, because the guy next door had seen me go in there, happened to be looking out the window, and noticed I didn't come out and the motor's running, and he ambled over and found me dead in the car. And he pulled me out, and they hit on my chest and breathed my mouth, and they rushed me to the hospital and oxygenated me and spent 2 or 3 days examining me and determined I was seriously mentally ill and committed me to the state insane asylum, not to an alcoholic ward, but to the insane asylum as a intense schizophrenic with paranoid tendencies. Well, and after I was in there a couple of weeks for some reason, I guess they must have been sedating me. I was starting to feel better. That's why I wanted to get out of there. I found a way to escape, but they brought me back and gave me a lot of electric shock treatments. And the next year, I was wondering, how the hell am I going to get out of here? because you had to be well, and I couldn't pass any wellness test because I was too intense. And the state of Texas did me a great favor. They started the first experimental alcoholic ward in the state of Texas in a state hospital in Big Spring while I was there, a man named Les Ross, who lived there. And I found that out, and I'd been in and out of AA for 7 or 8 years by now, and I knew what AA's like to hear. I knew I wasn't an alcoholic, but I also knew what AA's like to hear. And so I hustled him. By this time, I was the mailman at the hospital going around from ward to ward. And I nailed him one day. I said, "Mr. Ross, I'm here on a commitment from El Paso. This is suicide, but it was that damn drinking that made me crazy. I understand you have some sort of a program over there. Is there some kind of a book I could read or any kind of literature? Because if I could just return to my lost God and get away from the alcohol." Poor old man had never seen a sincere newcomer before. In that particular program they had in the 1950s, you were committed to the hospital. Your family had you committed. You had no say in it. And you had to go in there for 30 days and get alcoholic information and then be sent home. And these people in there just hated it, you know. I got transferred to that ward finally as an experimental case, whether psychiatric patients should be able to go. And I sat in there, and I was just wonderful for Mr. Ross, because all the other guys in there just... You say to the guy, "What are you doing to get out of here, Fred?" "I'm going to kill that bitch." I played him like a zither, I'll tell you. And in a few months, I was released as a recovered alcoholic. And I never had another drink until I ran out of Thorazine. But I was still on probation to my wife when I left Dallas. And so that's why I averted my head and became, I didn't want them to see me because I knew it would be all over. I'd be in there till I die. I got to El Paso and looked up some friends and I got drunk and I got in my car and got some money from them because I'd had no dough and got as far as Phoenix. And got in a beef on the street with some guy. Turned out to be a cop. And he arrested me and he put me in the Phoenix jail overnight. Even hotter than it is here, about 106. And in the middle of the night, I was so sick. Got up and vomited on the toilet. Turned out to be some guy's bunk, actually. And there was nobody in the bunk. But I laid down next to I felt better. I laid down next to his bed and went to sleep. And the guy came back and found me laying next to his bunk with vomit. And he got cross. He says, "You damn drunken son of a bitch!" And kicked my front teeth out. That was one of the few mornings I was glad I'd been in psychoanalysis because I was almost instantly able to identify his problem. I remember thinking, this son of a bitch is overreacting. And I got out of the jail the next morning and I didn't know where to go. I was sick and I lost the car. I couldn't remember where the car was and all my clothes were in it and I had nothing. I was covered in vomit and dorm suit. And I looked up the AA club. That's all you can do in a case like that. Maybe hustle an AA if you can. And I wasn't an AA hustler, but when you're dying, you got to do something. And I found something called the Arid Club on North 3rd Street, and I walked over there and told some old lady I needed money for a 12-step house, and she gave it to me, and I got to Los Angeles, and I couldn't get out of Los Angeles. A guy that I knew was a radio, I gave him a start down in Texas as a radio announcer. He's a star now in L.A., and I went to him and told him I had a terrible car accident, and I was waiting for his money, and he gave me about $100. And I spent it for over a period of a couple of weeks. I remember one night even going to an AA club and just, somebody had me go in there. But I ran out of dough again. I went back to the station again, another rainy night. I said, "I think we need, my money hasn't come yet." And he said, "No, I called Dallas about you. You've had an accident. You're just turning into a bum. Stay with the station. Here's $5. He threw the $5 in a mud puddle." And I picked it up. God, That's as disturbing to me as almost anything I've ever done. Because you really, your pride is gone. And a couple of days later, I woke up one morning, I found myself being thrown out of a Skid Row mission in Los Angeles. And say, and stay out of here, you damn bum. And I tried to explain to him, I'm not a bum. 3 years ago, I was on the faculty of the University of Texas. Ads that I helped write, the old L.C. Delmer ads, were running that very week in Life, and Time, and Saturday Evening Post. I've had my picture in the New York Times for one of my achievements. How many people do you know have had their picture in the New York Times for one of their achievements? But it's hard to explain these things in midair, you know. And I stood outside of that stinking old mission on that cold, rainy morning. And I just had such a terrible feeling. I didn't know what it was. Since I identified, I think, by listening to other people. But you get to a point where there is no friendly direction. There's no direction to go back to. You've burned them off. You've burned the bridges. There's no direction that if you follow it long enough, someone's going to be glad to see you. And I stood there, I just couldn't believe this could be happening to me. I'm too smart. I remember thinking, maybe if this is a dream, any minute my wife's going to wake me up and say, Clancy, God, you kicked off all your covers. Come on, get up, go to work. But it wasn't. I stood there. And if some old God come up to me that morning and said, you know, Slim, you're dying. You're down to 120-some pounds. You've lost your wife and children. You'll never see them again. You've lost your career. Once upon a time, they called you a boy genius. Now you can't even get a job washing dishes. You've lost your clothing. You'll never see that again. You're an only child, and your mother up in Wisconsin is not allowed to accept phone calls from you anymore because your stepfather's so tired of watching you manipulate her and play on her sympathies to get a little more money, to get another start. He'd rather have her think you're dead than the way you are. Now, you've been in and out of AA almost 10 years now, and you're sitting in meetings and smugly and smirking at these idiots, and you feel so different and sometimes so above them. But I'm telling you something. Why don't you, for God's sakes, go back to AA one more time before you die? It's going to be all over. And admit you're an alcoholic and concede to your innermost self or whatever it is they say and do something about it. And if some old guy had come up to me that morning and said that, if I were in a mood to be honest, I'd have had to say to him, pal, it isn't the way it looks. It isn't the way it looks. I'm not an alcoholic. I wish I were. I would give it. I know there's something wrong with me. I've noticed since I was a little boy. I've always known there's things wrong with me. I'm not enough somehow. There's something missing inside of me. And I don't fit in well, and I don't mix, and I don't feel like equal a lot of times. I feel like I'm always playing catch-up all my life. And I've tried a lot of things for it, but I discovered when I was 15 years old, and I ran away from home early in the Second World War and was out in a ship in the ocean. Some guys got me to drink some whiskey. It made me sick for a while, but eventually I drank it and held it down, and I discovered that's how you overcome that feeling. I don't drink because I'm a drinker. I drink because I'm a feeler. And drinking is the only thing I've ever found that makes me feel at all the way men look. I don't know any other way to do it. And sometimes I drink too much. Then people think I have a drinking problem. They don't seem to understand, you know. I remember thinking about that in Dallas. I was got a DUI here once. He explained, God, why don't these people understand? Why don't they have a test to give you, take a drop of blood out of your urine, discover the days, see how inadequate you feel today and how you don't fit in. Or maybe have a white line to walk that can prove how different you feel. And maybe a breathometer that you can breathe into. They can say, oh, this guy really needs some love and some understanding instead of just being pushed around. But they don't have those tests. They just have tests to give you when you drink to overcome those feelings, and sometimes you drink too much. But at one time I thought I might be an alcoholic, but I realized being an alcoholic doesn't make you crazy when you're sober. It's supposed to make you feel better. So I had to say to the guy, well, I'm not an alcoholic, pal. I wish I were. And if he'd said, well, prove you're not an alcoholic, I wouldn't have been able to do that because I wouldn't have had the objectivity to stand back and delineate the differences. So I probably would have done what people like me do when we get tired and get afraid and you get cornered. You take refuge behind bluster. You say things like, oh, get out of my face, goddammit. Leave me alone. Get away from me. Because I don't know the right answer. I know the answer now. I've known it for a lot of years. I didn't know it then. And the answer is quite simple. Why, I knew and would be willing to bet my life I wasn't really an alcoholic. And not because of my drinking. I went to A off and on. I went to Town North. When I was here, there's only two clubs, Town North and Suburban. And I went to Town North. In fact, it got so bad at the end when I was working at Tracy Locke. I would get up in the morning on Drexel Drive over here, which is just a block the other side of the freeway, and drive down and stop at the Suburban Club, which was next to some tennis courts down there. And I'd go in there every morning. There's a guy swamping at 7 o'clock. And I'd say, God, I got to get through today. I'm going to lose my job. He'd say, well, have some coffee. We'll do something. And I could make it till noon, and then I just need a couple of drinks. I couldn't stand it. And by nightfall, I was drunk again. And next morning, I'd be back doing the same thing. Just on and on. I just don't know how to explain to people that my problem is not drinking. I wish it were. Jesus, I'd do something about it. The reason I can see why I knew I was an alcoholic was this. I drank like an alcoholic. I drank more than most alcoholics I ever heard. I sit around AA meetings talk about drinking. I talk about drinking. I've been in jail 32 times. Not big deals overnight, because I have a tendency to counsel policemen when I drink. Because I believe in fair play. But, you know, 32 times in jail is not a record in AA, but it's good for an advertising executive. You know. It means you got to learn to take showers quick in the morning and get to work. Been in a nut house. You've done all of these things. But the one thing I could never overcome is this. Whatever shattered, shredded piece of integrity I had left was this. The one thing that kept me from being an alcoholic. Now, if you're kind of new, we have some new people here tonight. I'll tell you something. If you come to this club, to, I guess, the open speakers meeting that you mentioned Friday night, every Friday for the next year, you will hear 52 different people get up here. They will talk about different stories, different backgrounds, different histories. I mean, we have guys out of work here tonight. We have ex-symphony conductors here tonight. We're all the same thing. But the one thing you will hear that's a thread through it all, I used to drink and my life was terrible. And I came to AA and got sober, and now I'm doing better. That's one thing you'll hear every speaker say. That's the one thing I couldn't break down. Unlike alcoholics, it is when I stop drinking, clean my act, that's when it gets painful. And the longer I stay sober, and the more I go to meetings, the more all these things, the worse it gets. And eventually I got to take a couple drinks. And if I ever stop sober drinking, one time I stopped drinking, all in all, for my little boy, and I wound up dead. So what is that? Is that an alcohol problem? Obviously not. But I stood in that street corner that morning. I didn't know where to turn. And I thought, well, I'll go back to that damn AA club if I can find it and maybe hustle a few bucks and get out of town somehow. I've got to do something. I'm going to die. And I asked some guy, where's the AA club? I don't remember. It was Wilshire and Fairfax, wherever the hell that might be. And the guy said, well, Fairfax doesn't go all the way downtown here. You have to go up Hill Street and then cut over to Wilshire to go west. And it was raining, but I started off. And I walked and walked and walked. And I was terribly desperate. And I counted later in my car some years later, it was 72 long blocks. That's a long way to walk when you're sick and raining and desperate. A woman in New York asked me one time, how could you possibly walk that far when you were so desperate? And the answer is quite simple. That's the only time you can. You can't do it any other time, but you can do it that time. And I got to this club, and they weren't glad to see me in there. Oh, here's that smart-ass son of a bitch. I guess I'd been rather mouthy. And I lurked around the club, and that night they had a meeting, and I ate about 4 pounds of cake. And my gums were still bleeding. My lips were swollen from that being kicked. And they had a meeting on gratitude, and I almost puked the cake back up again. and I had no place to sleep. And I thought, these damn AAs, when I had money, I used to support them. I said, I have no place to stay, and everybody's gone home. So there's something I could do. He said, yeah, you're in luck. Out in the parking lot, an old guy named Joe Quinn left an old 49 Merc there last summer. It's in that tall grass. You can sleep in that. I said, you want me to sleep in an abandoned car? He said, yeah, good deal, huh? Yeah. So I slept down in an abandoned car, and morning I got up, it was Sunday morning, I went in, ate about 4 pounds of cake, and somebody talked about Jesus or God or somebody that wasn't in good with. And I just kept raining. That afternoon I went upstairs in this club, there were some little rooms, and I found one room, and there was a little TV sitting there, and I turned it on, it was a black and white TV. And that TV saved my life, because I sat and watched a football game. And I'd been a sports writer as a young man. I was interested in sports, and I held my attention for a couple hours. And then there was a meeting that night. Night cake and listened to the crap and slept in the abandoned car. I got up the next morning, it was raining. I went upstairs and my TV set and turned on soap operas and just on and on. I remember thinking, maybe I'm dead. Maybe I'm dead. Maybe this is what hell is. Just a... spend every day in the rain listening to people tell me about 12 wonderful goddamn steps. And I had no idea then or thereafter that would be my sobriety day, because I didn't want it to be. I got sober a lot of times for jobs, for love, for people, for memories, for sadnesses. But there's no reason to stay sober this time. And I somehow stayed sober. You know, they say there are no authorities in AA. There are authorities. They'll tell you who they are. They are people who live far away. They always know more than anybody in town. Every time you have a convention in Texas, you bring in speakers from California and New York and Chicago. We have speakers in California. We bring in speakers from Chicago and New York and Texas. They have speakers in New York. It's always the same thing. If you're from far away, you're an authority. That's why I'm here tonight, as a matter of fact. But I am kind of an authority in Toronto, Canada. Because I go there every February. They have a day, and that tells you all you need to know about my speaking abilities. The good speakers go north in the summer and south in the winter. I go to Toronto in February and Dallas in September. Yeah. I don't care. Love is the answer. Anyway. I go there, and every morning, in the mornings, I talk about the history of AA or the traditions, or last year they had me talk about Bill Wilson. I'm one of the few people left who ever spent an hour talking to him in his office. And in the afternoon, they have a question-answer session on AA with a big authority answering questions. Then at night I give a talk. And I really have discovered I have a kind of facility for question and answer meetings. I have a natural bent. I seem to have a facility to be able to weave a veritable tapestry of verbal BS while I think of the answer. Let's go back to the roots of that problem. I was talking a few years ago, and some lady in the back said, Clancy, I have a question. If you don't mind, I wouldn't like one of your long answers. I thought, somebody ought to slap that bitch. But I didn't say anything because I'm too nice a guy. That's But she says, every year you come and you tell all the years you slept and how horrible it was and how bad and you lost everything. Now you've been sober forever. How wonderful it is and how wonderful you are. What was the difference? What happened in between? What? Just in a sentence or two, tell us what made the difference. Yeah, there's no possible way you could tell that difference in a sentence or two. It's ridiculous. I really was cross. She broke my rhythm. I just... But that night I was taking a shower before my meeting, and the answer came. An answer came. A correct answer. A one-sentence answer. But it's a stupid answer. It isn't the answer I want to give. I like answers. I've I give answers with a little panache, with a little body, with a little zip. I'd like to have the newcomers tonight leave here and say things like, "Did you hear what Clancy said?" "Wet birds do not fly at night." I'd like to have them say things like, "Did you hear what Clancy said? Never mind if the horse is blind. Keep loading the wagon." Now, these answers mean nothing, but they give the newcomer hope. The answer I thought of was so corny and sick that I hated it. This was the first time I ever felt so bad that I remembered that I found myself doing things in AA that I thought were stupid and beneath my dignity, and allowing people who didn't deserve to tell me what to do. I don't mean big things. I don't mean like writing inventories. I mean little things. Like in those days, for example, I went to meetings all the time because that's where I ate cake and slept in a club. But in those days, there were no styrofoam cups like we're drinking out of tonight. Just porcelain cups. So every meeting, they'd have people wash dishes. And people get sick of washing dishes, you know. "Are you? You without the teeth. You want to wash dishes tonight?" And if I had any integrity or strength left, I'd have said, "No, I don't want to wash dishes tonight. I want you to lick them off with your ugly tongue, you old bastard." You know? But I was so afraid I wouldn't have any place to sleep, so I'd say, Another night, somebody, "You want to help us stack chairs today?" "Come early tomorrow night and set up the meeting." And I did this, and I stepped slowly, keeping that scar. It was just hideous. And I finally stayed sober a little while, and just living, I just gave up on ever living again. Just then, if you stay sober a little while, the next step they do, if you're around the club, they say things like, "Get a sponsor. Time to get a sponsor." I've had sponsors. In El Paso, I had the editor of the El Paso Times. In Dallas, I had Dr. John, who was a very famous child doctor here, is why he became my sponsor. Dr. John Ashby, because I could get free treatment for my kids. But they all seem to be so nice. If you're new, you're going to hear, "Oh, the sponsor's wonderful." But no matter how nice they seem, I want to warn you, sooner or later, they want to stick their nose in your business. And this guy was, I seen him in and out of the club. He's an actor in the movies. "Hi, let me help you. That's my new sponsor. I want to get some money from him. I'm going to get my teeth fixed up. I'll get some clothes. I'll go back east, get a job in a big agency. I'll make some money again. I'll come back to Los Angeles with money in my pocket. I'll buy this club and I'll burn the goddamn thing." I said, "Bob, would you be my sponsor? I want what you have." "All right, kid, but I want you to do what I tell you." "Oh, sure, Bob." Then you say this, they like to hear this. "I want sobriety on an all-time basis." And he became my sponsor. I thought about him many times. I look back, he should have won the Academy Award for every loving role he ever played in the movies, because they were totally foreign to his basic nature. He turned out to be a right-wing fascist AA pig. Just "You want me to ring your bell now, Bob?" He gave me a lot of crap. You know something? I used to think about that. Why would I take that crap from that guy? Because my stock in trade as an adult at that time was, I don't take crap from anybody. I've quit big jobs because somebody gave me a little too much crap. You want to give me that crap? Get yourself another boy. Find someone as talented as me, maybe. Screw you. I don't know how many nights in bars in this town and every other town I ever lived in. Somebody might imply I didn't seem to be very much. You don't think so, son of a bitch? Try me. And I get knocked out of my can a lot. But they know I'm tough. That's what I want. Now, I've often thought, why would I always have to be in such a mood of always having to be so much? And once I was sober a while and listened to a guy's inventory, he was reading his inventory to me, and I thought, my God, that's it, my life. You know why? Because all my life, I always secretly knew I was a weakling. And I hate it. I hate being a weakling. And no one's ever going to find out. I'll be tough, and I'll be slick, and I'll be smart. They'll never, and I'll fight, I'll do whatever. I'll quit jobs. Just imply I'm not good enough, and I'll do whatever you dare me to do. And the irony about AA is if you stay here long enough and do these dumb things over a period of time, eventually you become strong like you always wanted to be. And when you become strong, then you can afford to be weak. But you can't afford to be weak when you're weak. Funny. But why did I take that crap from this guy? I'll tell you why. Because as far as I know, somehow I began to get a feeling that he knew how I felt. And I don't know what word was in our conversation that came out, but I'm sure other people gave me the same information. But I had never felt anybody really knew how I felt and why I drank and what was wrong with me. And I got the feeling he did little by little. That's that miracle in AA called identification, which is the germ of all sobriety, I believe, eventually. But I got to believe that he... I'll tell you why that's important. There isn't anybody in this room who hasn't had enough information, enough advice by the time they're 21 to last them forever. People always give you advice. But it's just information. You don't understand. My case is different, on and on. But somehow, if you can find someone, stay long enough to find out someone who you might think knows what they're talking about or know how you feel, that information becomes advice. And I might follow it, not very much of it and not willingly, but I follow it because he may understand. And little by little, I begin to do little things that I wouldn't ordinarily have done because he told me to. And I sometimes resent him for it. I mean, for example, after about a month, I was hanging around the club, I was eating cake, and people would occasionally buy me a sandwich, or one guy would throw me an apple every so often. Here, somebody, you can eat this, kid. I must find him and make amends someday. But one day I said, Bob, I can't live like this. I'm living in an abandoned car. People think I'm stupid. I'm hungry a lot of the time. I'm cold. I got these old clothes, Bob. What am I going to do? He said, get a job. I said, get a job, for Christ's sake. Look how terrible I look. He said, get a terrible job. Well, I followed that direction to the perfection. When I had a bunch of terrible drugs, got fired off some of them, I always had a smart mouth. But little by little, I stayed sober. Finally, some guy let me sleep on his sofa in his basement. I was on my way for about 2 weeks, then his wife got upset because I was putting out cigarettes under the sofa on the rug. Well, that night, the ashtray was across the room, that's all. So I was back in my abandoned car. And another guy let me stay in his house, in his little apartment. And one morning at 3 o'clock in the morning, he tap on the chamber door. He went to the door, and there's some girl there, and he came back and said, my girl is here. We haven't been together for 2 or 3 months, you know what I mean? Would you mind just taking a walk for a couple hours till... This was 3 in the morning. I'm working a spiritual program. I said, Jim, why don't you have her hit the street? She's more used to it than I am. I was back in my abandoned car that night. Right after that deal, I was about 6 months sober, and a guy had now got me a job as a dishwasher. at the Gaiety Delicatessen. I was doing terribly, just terrible. And I thought, I'll be a good dishwasher. I was doing the dishes, and suddenly, little by little, I lost the job within a day. And because I began to observe, the busboys are bringing in more dishes than the waitresses are taking out. These guys are getting dishes in other restaurants to humiliate me because I'm an Anglo. So I just piled up a lot of this. I got fired. I decided to kill myself. I'm not even an alcoholic yet. And I can't even hold a job washing this. And people I wouldn't hire to mow my lawn are doing good and getting jobs and having cars. And I'm living in the backseat of an abandoned car, for Christ's sake. Why not be dead? Maybe all those sins prevent me from being... So I decided to walk in the ocean. I had no car anymore to do it. And I didn't know exactly how to get there. I knew I had to go back to La Cienega and over to Wilshire, then west. And I walked and walked. And of course, I couldn't find the ocean. I just... I stopped and guessed, where's the ocean? So I was in Western Beverly Hills. You have to go past the Veterans Hospital. Then about another 5 miles after that. Oh, no. I don't mind dying, but I'm not going to walk myself through it. Now, I'll call my sponsor, but I hate to call him because every time I lost a job, he just chewed me a new butt. And I just hate to tell him bad news. It suddenly struck me. I used to be an award-winning writer. I got my picture in magazines, advertising gains for my writing. I should be able to create a story that is so touching and beautiful that even this cold-hearted, rotten bastard will... So I said, Bob, this is the client says, why aren't you working? Bob, let me explain something to you. You know, I've lost my wife and kids. I'll never see them again. That's okay. And I've lost my career. I accept that. And I've ruined everything. But he said, AA at least would let me live comfortably. If there's something you don't know about AA, Bob, when you're not around, which isn't very often because you're traveled, in AA, people treat me badly. They really do. I mean, I go to meetings. They call on me once. They never call on me again. I sit around the club. People tell newcomers to stay away from me because I'm a loser and I'll pull them down. I try to... Every woman in the world tells their baby not to talk to me. No one likes me, Bob. There's no place to turn. And it suddenly struck me, this is true. And I burst into tears. It was the saddest... What am I going to do, Bob? For Christ's sake, what am I going to do? And he said, why don't you write your damn inventory the way I told you? Well, that got my heart started again, you know. So I just told him a week before, I've taken my inventory to the psychiatrist for many, many thousands of dollars. Why should I take it with an out-of-work actor? What are you going to do, say, cut, shoot it again? What the hell's that? Yeah. I didn't want to say that and hurt his feelings. But I said, Bob, you don't understand. That helps people, but alcohol is not really my problem. In my judgment, taking inventory is the last thing in the world I need. My God, I'm so full of remorse and regret and fear and despair. I need something that'll help me. And he explained that to me. He said, in your judgment? Who cares about your judgment? You live in an abandoned car, for Christ's sake. If I wanted your judgment, I'd put my head in the back window and ask you for it. He said, you're a loser. You're a loser. I came out of that phone booth. I'm glad I turned. If I'd have turned right, I'd have been in the ocean in three steps. I got back to the club and said, Sullivan, give me some paper. I'm writing my inventory. And I had a paper, and he gave me a pad, and I wrote, I wrote terrible things. Things I'd never breathed to a soul. Never. Just terrible, rotten, nasty, petty. Guy asked me one time, why don't you tell those things to your psychiatrist? Because if you're paying that kind of money, you can't risk rejection. That's why you don't tell your psychiatrist. I don't want some old boob to say to me, you did what, sir? Get out of my office. But first, wash off that chair. But I wrote this crap down, and then I felt better because at least it didn't work, so it cheered me up a little.
I shut in the back seat of my car, and a couple days later, he came by, and this guy said, okay, kid, go take your inventory. I'm not tonight. I don't really. Ah, shut up. He explained. I got in the car, and we went from Santa Monica to Oxnard. He gave me a flashlight, and I read this hideous thing. It read worse than I remembered. It just. Oh. I thought, he's going to make me get out of the car at Oxnard and I have to walk 40 miles back. I said, well, that's the end of it, Bob. He said, is that all? Yeah. You know, that's the best thing you've done since you got sober, kid. And I said, thought it was. I've taken that same trip over 200 times since then. On the driver's side, and some other pukes over there. Let me explain this part before I read it. It's an amazing thing how similar. I've heard all kinds of inventory. Some few years ago, 1 week, I heard the daughter of one of the most famous men in the 20th century, and a few days later, a guy that was born under the bridge in El Paso never knew who his father was. Same inventory. They're not the same inventory, but they all contain the same elements. Good inventories contain the same elements. Lack of self-worth, guilt, much anger, much resentment, and occasional lashing out at the world to punish them for hurting me. And every inventory that I've ever heard has those elements in it if it's a good inventory. That's why AA works, because it works at a level you can't judge. It's working down deep where you have to just keep taking action and not understanding it even. I've been active a lot of years now. And I've been sober a lot of years. I've been active all these years. So the last few years I've had an opportunity to do some things that some of you haven't had a chance to do yet. For example, the last few years I've been asked to come and speak in Cape Town, South Africa, and Johannesburg, and Berlin, and London, and Belfast, and Oslo. And earlier this year I was on toured Australia and New Zealand. You'd think you'd find exotic AA in these places, but I'll tell you something. Except for the accents, you hear the same things here, you hear there, everywhere all over the world. In the last analysis, AA all over the world is the same. In every meeting, in every group, there's a bunch of people who have come here pain and feeling different and somehow have allowed themselves to be led into taking actions they don't necessarily agree with, but it's by little changed their perception and they find themselves feeling better and now they understand what their problem is and they are in the meetings on a continuing basis. And also in every group, there's a group of people who cannot or will not take these actions, who sneer at the people who do, who laugh and ridicule and hover on the fringes. And then in the middle are new people. And both of these groups fight for their souls. They say, you don't have to do that crap. You have to do this stuff. And it's amazing we keep as many people as we do because the arguments against AA are better than the ones for it in a sense. But little by little, it's all over the world. And later I made amends. For example, my first amend I had to make was my father, who I hadn't talked to in 10 years. I hated him. But he made me make amends to him. I, over a period of time, do a lot of things that wound up eventually when my father was old and sick, living at my house. And when he died, I was holding his hand. But it never would have happened if I had been an AA. And I had to make amends and do things. And I stayed sober. I finally got a little job when I was 2 years sober as a writer in a medical corporation. But I went to work every day. I didn't have any front teeth yet. But I learned to carry my lip like this. A lot of people thought I'd been burned in a fire. And my sponsor insisted I go to work every day. On that job, I learned some great spiritual lessons. You want to hear some great spiritual lessons? You might think prayer and meditation. Yeah, they are. But let me tell you some other big ones. Big ones. Do what you said you would do. Be where you said you would be when you said you would be there. Don't take out your hostility on people who can't answer back. Employees, children, waiters and waitresses. On days you know you're having a bad day, watch that mouth. Because without even knowing it, you can just cut people up and ruin relationships and ruin friendships and many other things. I didn't ever do them very well. But I learned it well enough, so when I was 5 years sober, I was director of advertising for that corporation. I had some front teeth now, and I smile. If you're new and you've lost some teeth, let me give you some hope. Once you become spiritually pure, they grow back. I don't exactly know how that works. When I was 7 years sober, another guy and I were brought into Hollywood. We created something called Boss Radio, became the number one hard rock station in the world. And we all wore shiny suits and said things like, "What's coming on down, baby?" But you get sick of pimping to teenagers. When I was 10 years sober, I was downtown doing public relations for oil companies. 15 years sober, I was a marketing director in Beverly Hills. When I was 5 years sober, the same wife and all those children heard the crinkle of green in my pocket all the way to a post office box in Dallas, leaped out of their post office box, fled to my side. 9 months and 10 seconds later, another dependent came along. I tell you, I cried when that kid was born because I finally had another boy again to grow, raise. And they're all grown up now. Three of my kids are in AA, just all turning 11 this year. And the others aren't in AA because they don't need to be. Only one of my kids has ever gone bad. I guess it has to every. My oldest daughter is a DA in Albuquerque. I'd so hope she'd be a public defender, but no. But it's all very nice. I live in a house out by the ocean where the breezes blow incessantly. It never gets hot like this. And I've come here tonight at tremendous expense and no little inconvenience to tell you all about. Is there a new person here in the first 30 days? Anybody? Anybody? You are, ma'am? Let me tell you something that's going to make you feel better. I've got it all together and you haven't. But I know you're happy for me. That's what counts. That's a terrible thing. I didn't say that to be cruel. I really want to see where you were. I'm going to give you a 4-minute talk now, and we're going to be done. All the rest of this was the introduction to entertain these boobs. The most important thing I said tonight, kid, I'll say before I sit down, I said, my name is Clancy Emerson, and I'm an alcoholic. And when you leave, you may wonder, well, when did that old fool become an alcoholic? Was he an alcoholic when he drank? Was he an alcoholic when he got sober? Now, I couldn't be an alcoholic because my problem isn't alcohol. And fortunately, I took actions I didn't agree with and didn't believe in and allowed people to superimpose judgments over mine, much to my chagrin. And I somehow survived long enough to discover the book Alcoholics Anonymous says something that I didn't even know it said, and I'd been around in and out for years. It says my problem is not alcohol. In fact, to extrapolate it, if my problem is alcohol, I'm not an alcoholic. Now, doesn't that sound weird? Of course the problem is alcohol. Everybody knows that. I can disprove that in 5 seconds. If alcohol is the problem, detoxes turn out recovered people. And they don't. Treatment centers turn out recovered people. Jails, hospitals. They turn out sober people with varying amounts of information what may be wrong with them. But I'll guarantee if they be like me, or as our book says, of our type, you will always drink again, or sedate. And what is it? Why could this be? What is the problem here? Well, it's something we all know we have, but we don't know it, necessarily understand it. It is not alcohol. It is something called alcoholism, which sounds the same. But tremendously different. I'll guarantee you, your life and sanity will depend on it someday. An alcohol problem is overcome by stopping drinking and cleaning up your act and doing good. In the strange thing called alcoholism, which unfortunately for you and me looks exactly the same to the naked eye, you'll discover that this mind-consuming, perception-distorting, bodily-eroding thing, you'll eventually discover that if you stop drinking and clean up your act, it has no significant effect on your life other than to gradually make it so painful you can't stand it another minute. But even that doesn't make you an alcoholic. You must be one of the 7 or 8% of people, nobody knows exactly, who get an unnatural reaction to alcohol in addition to all this. So what's the unnatural reaction? Well, you hear podiums say, I stayed drunk for 20 years, round the clock. No human body can stay drunk two straight weeks around the clock. In a laboratory, that's what's the rottenest thing about drinking. You keep sobering up again and again and again. Well, it makes you act crazy. You got to hear these people say, and then I broke out of San Quentin and broke into Menninger's clinic and raped two nuns. Then I went down here. In my job today, I see alcoholics die. Someone died earlier this week. Some of them haven't ever acted crazy once. Didn't really got sick enough to. So what is this unnatural thing that I can't understand? And if you understand that, kid, it'll change your life. It turns out that the unnatural effect of alcohol has to be something that it does for you, not to you. It has to almost instantly change your perception of reality. It has to alter your relationship to your environment. It has to fill holes that nothing else does. And if it does that, it's wonderful. And I never knew it didn't do that for everybody. I never knew it didn't do that for everybody. That's why, as was said earlier tonight, I couldn't understand why people don't drink. And they can't understand why I do. But when I drink, it's great. They talk a lot about drugs. I hope they don't talk about it in AA. But they talk a lot about drugs. I'm not an addict, but I've been working with addicts for 25 years. I think I know more about addiction than most addicts. I know about heroin, the great euphoria that comes, and eventually you can't get there anymore, so you have to overdose. Heroin addicts always die from overdoses when they die. Keep shooting up. Sometimes they get so desperate, they go in the hospital, kick the drugs, so they can come out and get that feeling again. Cocaine, great omnipotence. Now, where I work is down to crack cocaine, this terrible, addictive, hideous stuff. Makes you feel omnipotent for a while, but eventually the side effects of speed drugs are always the same. Gradually growing paranoia, discomfort, terrible addiction. In alcohol, this doesn't happen. It makes you feel like you want to feel. And at the end, it gets kind of bad sometimes, but for a long time, it's just kind of an inconvenience. You guard it. So you try only not drinking at home or not drinking at work or changing from scotch to brandy, because I can't go without it, but I got to find a way to do it. Now, the great thing about this is this. If alcohol works for you, it's wonderful, except for one drawback. If it can alter my perception of an unsatisfactory sobriety, conflict-ridden sobriety, I would think you're tough, I drink. And which leaves these untaken care of. So the next time I get sober, they're a little bit worse. And eventually I get sober. But I can't stay sober, so I got to drink. But I can't keep drinking, so I got to stay sober. And I can't stay sober, so I got to drink. That's called alcoholism. And today in America, where there's more sobriety than any place in the history of mankind, it's estimated about 95% of alcoholics still die drunk. A number of people in this room will die drunk. Long, painful, hard deaths. Not, might be me, might be you. I don't know. I remember my sponsor told me that, and I thought, oh, Jesus, more recruiting talk from this old guy. Until a few years later, he got mad at AA and stopped going to meetings. He died drunk, and he knew more about AA than anybody I knew. Because, like the book says, our sobriety is predicated upon the maintenance of our spiritual condition. Does that mean you have to pray incessantly? No. The spiritual condition we do here are the actions of AA, of getting out of self, of trying to be of service to others. I talked earlier about the International Convention. Probably the greatest, I want to just quote something to you. In 1950, they're having a lot of problems getting AA to accept the traditions. And most of AA wouldn't accept them. So Bill and Dr. Bob decided everybody get together and have one meeting and see they're not so different. And so they had a meeting in Cleveland where they had representatives from all the groups, from Texas and Houston, Dallas, Los Angeles. And they accepted the traditions. One of the great moments of that, I had the tapes of that convention, 1950. Their quality is bad, but they're really good. Dr. Bob was dying of cancer. And they said, you probably won't want to talk, Dr. Bob. And he said, oh, yes. Next to Bill, I got the most sobriety in the world. And so on July 4th, they held a tall, gaunt, sick man to the podium. And he said, I'm just so glad to have you here. I hope you'll go back and tell the boys and girls in your communities that we're all working together. And And I'm sorry that my health has not been very good lately. I've been in bed much of the time. And I'm glad that some small thing I did 15 years ago helped bring this about. But he said, I would indeed be remiss if I didn't call your attention to two or three things. And then he gave what I conceived to be the Gettysburg Address of Alcoholics Anonymous. Short and right down the middle. Boom. He said, first, let us remember to keep our program simple. Let us not louse it all up with Freudian complexes, which may be of interest to the scientists, but have nothing to do with our work here. Our work here, when reduced to the last, consists of love and service. And we all know what love is, and we all know what service is. And secondly, he said, let us guard that erring member of the tongue and try to use it with kindness and understanding. And there isn't a person in this room or any room like in the world that doesn't know exactly what he meant. We're all very nice when we're feeling good, but when we get threatened or tired, cut, criticize, undermine. And finally, he said, let us never be too busy to help the man behind us. To give him a pat on the back when he needs it. To take him to a few meetings, because none of us would be here if someone hadn't done it for us. Let us never reach that stage of smug complacency. I love that phrase. When we're too busy to help our fellow alcoholic. Then he said a few closing remarks and sat down and was dead shortly thereafter. But that isn't a bad thing to remember. Smug complacency stands in our way. That mouth, our self-centeredness, because none of us are ever going to be wonderful. The last thing I want to tell you is that when I was 15 years sober, I, in some fit of strangeness, I left a job in Beverly Hills, and for the last 26 years, I run the mission on Skid Row that threw me out in 1958. And people said to me, why would you give up that great career to run that mission? And I never could be able to think of a good answer to that. Well, it was such a significant decrease in salary, I thought it was spiritual. It's not a treatment center. We're way below that. We're just dealing with dead, dying men, women, and children. When I get out of my car in the morning, I step over the bodies of dying men and women to get to my office. And when I go home at night, I step over the bodies of dying men and women to go home again. And I have a staff of 150 people, all of them off the street. Social scientists say this can't be done, but we can occasionally help people. And it's a funny thing. When I get to work in the morning, you know, think, isn't that wonderful? That old man is so dedicated. I get my car in the morning out by the ocean, and I got to drive downtown through Beverly Hills where I used to work. My car still wants to get off the road there. Let's go there. Let's not go down and see who died last night, who got stabbed, and who smashed their head into the sidewalk in a convulsion. But when I come home at night, I sometimes think about this. I feel more like a man. I haven't done much, but by God, I did the best I could today. And I get in my car and I feel better than I ever did going down those elevators, popping my fingers and being slick. Now, if you're new, you young lady or anybody else in this room, I don't want to give the wrong impression. Even if you go to AA, even if you surrender little by little your willfulness, even if you get a sponsor, even if you take these actions, even if you eventually become somewhat apt to live comfortably in the world, we can't guarantee you that in 15 years you can have your own mission. There's only so many go around. I've got mine. And but we can guarantee you, I think, that you walk with dignity. You walk with some degree of self-worth. You will eventually, as I did after being sober some time, come to believe that perhaps God loved even me. And not no more than you, no less than you, but as much as you. And it's up to me to do something about it, to live with some degree of hope that I have an ability to make my life comfortable much of the time. And when that day comes, you know, I thought about that tonight when Mark was driving by that house. I stood outside of that house, an empty house, all my possessions in a paper sack. And there is no way to get from there to here. But there's only one way, and it's right here. Thank you.